On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
When folks who like American history think about Civil War, they generally think of what's referred to south of the Mason-Dixon line as the War Between the States, 1861-1865. But the truth of the matter is, we had a Civil War decades earlier. We usually call that war the American Revolution, or the War for Independence. But as it turns out, the war that began in 1775 and went through 1783 was really America's first Civil War. To talk to us today is Tom Allen, the author of numerous history books, including George Washington, Spymaster, Remember Valley Forge, and his newest book, Tories, Fighting for the King in America's First Civil War, which is available from Harper One. Tom is a contributor to Smithsonian Magazine, National Geographic, Military History Quarterly, Military History Magazine, Naval History, Naval Institute Proceedings, and other publications. And it's our great pleasure to have Tom Allen with us today. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks for the chance.
First of all, let me say I was surprised, even though I have heard the statistics before, that so many people in the American colonies were not in favor of independence. I was surprised to discover in reading your book how many actual organized units there were of what we have come to call Tories and what they called of themselves loyalists during the American Revolution.
Yeah, it surprised me, too, when I started working on it. What started was the idea that here is George Washington at Valley Forge. I had written a book about Washington at Valley Forge, and it occurs to me while his men are starving and freezing 20 miles away, the British in occupied Philadelphia are going to dances and dinners and getting 3 square meals a day, and they're being supplied by Americans who were not supplying the Continental Army at Valley Forge. And it just struck me that somehow we think of Valley Forge as Washington against the elements when it's Washington against the Tories. I mean, there was a civil war going on. But our revolution, the grand story of our revolution, usually just leaves the Tories out of the picture.
Yeah, or glosses over them. Oh, yeah, we know they were there, and let's move on to something else. And I suppose part of that is because it's a little awkward. It's awkward to think that there were so many people in what is now the United States that were completely against the idea of breaking away from the king. They were loyal subjects of the king, and they saw no reason why we should not stay loyal subjects. And not only did they philosophically disagree with the war for independence, they put their bodies on the line and formed in a number of units that fought as regular units against their neighbors, their friends, their relatives, the American rebels, as they referred to them.
Right.
I think another thing that really surprised me was that I've always generally assumed, and I guess this is what they always warn you about, right? Those people who came from Scotland and from Ireland to the American colonies were looking for an opportunity to fight against the Brits, who basically kept kicking them out of their homes and stealing away their heritage. But as it turns out, that's not necessarily the whole picture going on in the American colonies, because a large number of the people who ended up being loyalists in the American colonies were the Scots, the Irish, and the Scots-Irish.
Right. The Scots-Irish were did turn up on both sides, but there were a great number of them, particularly the Highlanders, who fought for the king, no matter who the king was. I mean, these are, in some cases, some of the older Highlanders had actually fought for Bonnie Prince Charles against the sitting British king. But it turns out that they really liked the idea of kingship. They liked the idea of a monarchy. And the other thing was that they are, when you look at the picture a little more closely, they also are being recruited by British officers in America and are being offered large tracts of land, which will come with them with victory. In other words, when the British succeed in putting down the revolution, they will punish the rebels by giving large tracts of land to the loyalists who fought for the king. So that was quite alluring to them, and that was another reason they signed up. But they, in one of the first battles in which the Highlanders go up against the rebels, they are ferociously beaten, and they never really rally again. As they show up in other units, but British dependence on the Tories was always an iffy matter. They didn't really integrate the Tories into the British side of the war. The British army never had a good relationship with the Tories on a strategic level.
I kind of wonder if perhaps they just didn't completely trust them. I mean, this was a war that they were fighting against people who had been, many cases, were veterans of what we call the French and Indian War, what they called in Europe the 7 Years' War, and had been fighting as the allies of the British within a generation.
Right. George Washington himself was a hero of the 7 Years' War, or French and Indian War. Yeah, I think you've made a good point. They no matter who they were Americans, they weren't British. And if you really look deeper, you find that the Loyalists tend to be older Americans, in a sense, that many of the people who came over on the Mayflower, descendants of Mayflower passengers, are Tories. A lot of the revolutionaries have only been here one or two generations. A lot of the Tories were here for four generations and tracked themselves back, to the Mayflower and to the earliest British immigrants. But I think the overwhelming thing was the belief in kingship. I mean, the belief that if you were under the protection of the king, you were better off than being under the protection of a mob of yelling and screaming rebels. Yeah, I think that was what convinced a lot of people to take the Tory side.
Now, of course, as the war progressed, there were events that took place that changed loyalties back and forth. There were, apparently, this is something I'd never read anywhere else either, there were a fair number of people who fought for independence for a while, and then it figured either they were going to lose or they better hedge their bets, and they deserted and went to the Loyalist side. Those people would be particularly suspect, I would think, because if they switch side once, why not again?
Turncoats never really get full trust. But after the war was over and the British started figuring out how to reward those who had been faithful to the crown, they one of the categories, the lower categories, is people who were in the Continental Army and then went over to the British. But the highest possible loyalist in terms of gauging loyalty were those who actually fought for the king, picked up arms, went out in the battlefield, risked their lives, and killed other Americans. And there were a lot of them. There were at least two large battles and many small ones in which everybody on the field was an American.
That's particularly
a scattering of British officers.
That's really sad. One of the statistics that Tom brings out here is that by one tally, Loyalists fought in 576 of the war's 772 battles and skirmishes. And when you consider that there were really only one or two major pitched battles a year for most of the Revolutionary War years, that means a whole lot of skirmishes. And I don't like to quote movies as being historically accurate, because you, as a general rule, they tell a story and not necessarily history. But
right.
it seems to me that after reading your book, that a movie like The Patriot with Mel Gibson that came out 10, 11 years ago, where there was really vicious fighting between the Loyalist or Tories and the rebels or revolutionaries, and that was, it was personal and it was mean and it was gritty and it was, let's kill their wives and their children, let's burn down their houses kind of stuff. It really seemed to happen a lot more between the two sides of Americans and not necessarily the British. The British didn't seem to participate in the atrocities nearly as often as popular history would have us to think. It really just seemed to be more of an American versus American thing.
Yeah, it was, all the way from tar and feathering to, to outright lynchings. I mean, both sides. In the South, particularly, there was a lot of talk by Continental officers who came from New England and who viewed the war in the South particularly in the Carolinas, as savage. They used the word savage, and they said there were murders being committed, not just warfare. And the British were conducting what for that time was more or less conventional warfare, and underneath that conventional warfare was a guerrilla warfare being fought by both sides. And it was, one of the battles between Tories and rebels, and it went on for 4 days, and when it ends with the victory of the Tories, the commander of the Tories hangs 13 of the rebels from a banister in a house that they had taken over. It's that kind of warfare.
And it just goes back and forth, too. It's not at all one side being rotten to the others and the other side's being upright. They both did it back and forth, and that's particularly upsetting, and I can see why this isn't the sort of thing that gets written about very often.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me is that when you get to the Civil War that's between the North and the South, there's no hesitation to talk about some real brutal activities, but they always seem to me to always be the soldiers. It's not people who have just taken a rifle out of the house and run out and shot somebody. I mean, the Civil War that takes place in the 19th century is really between armies, whereas the Civil War that takes place inside the Revolution is really between military units that are not under the direct control of the organized armies.
Right. The militia units and the small units that are organized, the Rangers and so forth, remind me much more of the bushwhackers and jayhawkers in the border wars in, say, Kansas and Missouri, or the Appalachian units,
right.
Raiders during the war between the states. They have a lot more in common with those guys than they do with, say, the Continental Army under Washington, or during the Civil War, the Army of the Potomac or the Army of Northern Virginia or something.
Right. I think there was the idea that there was a hierarchy that was answerable to some kind of a political command. I mean, but what was going on, particularly there was an area in New York and New Jersey, mostly New Jersey, that was known as the Neutral Ground. And that was an ironic name for the fact that there would not be organized armies there as much as there would be guerrillas. And one guerrilla unit that became notorious had been started by William Franklin, the son of Benjamin Franklin, who had been the royal governor of New Jersey when the revolution begins. He manages to escape from custody of the rebels and winds up in New York, where he starts a force which was operating outside British control. And that they were famous for burning rebel houses and killing rebels in raids that were staged mostly in New Jersey. And every time there was a major movement of the Continental Army or the British Army, they would be pursuing each other. Every time there would be a shift in the armed power of the British Army or the Continental Army, there would be a shift in the loyalties of the citizens. At one point, George Washington says he just can't trust the people in New Jersey because they go one way and then another.
I've read a couple of books about Washington's leadership in the war, and it's pretty outstanding because he really is fighting at best an indifferent population and in sometimes totally antagonistic populations, as you started out this show by saying. Here you have the thing that Thomas Paine writes about, the Sunshine Patriots fading away and so forth, about the suffering in Valley Forge. 20 miles away, they're whooping it up in Philadelphia, the British are, and they're being supplied by not a long supply line from Great Britain, but the local merchants.
Right. It was something I didn't know until I started working on this. I think there was a tendency to write the history of the Revolution more and more as a kind of glorious revolution. It starts in Lexington and Concord. It ends in Yorktown, and whatever happens in between just doesn't really seem to get up into the mainstream understanding of the Revolution.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Thomas Allen, the author of a number of historical books and lots of articles. His latest book is Tories, Fighting for the King and America's First Civil War. It's from Harper Publications, a division of HarperCollins Publishers. Some of the statistics that you report are astonishing. For instance, there were pretty close to 100,000 Tories who left the colonies, which is six times the number of people who left France during their revolution. Yeah, a lot of them end up in Canada. As a matter of fact, do you say, what is it, a sixth of the people in Canada who are of English ancestry claim to be related to the Tories who went to Canada during the American Revolution?
Oh, yeah. If you talk to people in Canada today, depending on what part of Canada you're in, they will talk about 20% or, as you know, going up into the 60s or 50%. Of the Canadians today trace themselves back to loyalists. Genealogy is very big in Canada, and there are many of the records, or in fact most of the records of the loyalists wound up in Canada. And when I was doing research up there, I was talking to Canadians who really feel that the very character of Canada is you know, that kind of steadfast attitude that they have was traceable right back to the fact that their country got started by non-revolutionaries.
the whole relationship between America and Canada it would make a pretty interesting book too, because we invaded Canada during the Revolution, we invaded Canada during the War of 1812, and yet, ever since that point, we've had a wonderful relationship with Canada,
right?
And been great allies of theirs in two world wars and in the Cold War and everything. Of course, we did the same thing with Great Britain, but we didn't invade Great Britain during the Revolution or the War of 1812, which just says to me that there's a remarkably forgiving people up there.
Well, I live just a few miles from the White House that they burned down. Some Canadians came down here, too. I mean, it's often called the British, you know, but the Canadians joined right in.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were descendants or the sons of loyalists who had gone over at the end of the Revolution.
Another aspect of this war between Americans is that the British government decided to any slave who escaped was welcome to join the British Army,
right?
Or British or our loyalist units, and this sounds good. And there were a lot of slaves who did escape with the idea of getting freedom, but unfortunately, they were not treated all that well after the war was over. They didn't get the promised land. Matter of fact, apparently, a lot of them end up going into Sierra Leone. And
right,
yeah.
I mean, what's kind of interesting is that we get three new countries out of the Revolution: America, Canada, and Sierra Leone, because the former American slaves who go from Canada, they first of all they go to Canada, they're not well treated there, don't get good land, and about 1,500 of them go to Sierra Leone, and they become the ruling class in Sierra Leone, and the descendants of those ex-slaves have been running Sierra Leone ever since.
It's just a very fascinating subject, and nobody has ever really gone into it into a lot of depth. And once again, it's probably because we don't like to think that practically a half of the country fought the other half during our war for independence. We'd like for it to be, we all stood together as one. We fought against the British. They're buddies now, but boy, back in those days, we hated their guts, blah, blah, blah. And the truth of the matter is, obviously, it was a whole lot more complicated and dangerous than just us versus the Brits.
Yeah, and I think that, on the course of the research, I was talking to an Irish historian, and he says that every country has a grand story, and it gets developed over time. and things that don't quite fit into the grand story just kind of get forgotten, or they wind up underneath the grand story. And that's where the Tories wound up, that they were the forgotten people in the revolution. And they left very few memoirs or documents about themselves. The only good chance that you have for finding them is at the end of the war, the British appoint a commission to look into the claims of the Loyalists, and the Loyalists come forth and they say, "This is what I did for the revolution. This is what I did to be on the king's side." Even, you know, discounting a lot of the things they say, you do start to see the outline of the resistance that was taking place during the revolution. I mean, there were hundreds of military units formed. I mean, some of them quite sizable, 500 or 600 men in a regiment, and they really fought. As I said, there were battles where everybody on the battlefield, with few exceptions, are Americans fighting Americans.
Now there's one very famous American general who had been a hero, who was involved in an incredible, arduous overland attack on Canada, practically succeeded, was wounded more than once in the war, was a great hero, but he married the daughter of a prominent loyalist, and he ends up switching sides. That's Benedict Arnold. But according to your research for this book, somebody who never liked Washington, who was a pain in his side. As a matter of fact, Washington didn't even bother to try to get him back for a long time, because he just figured it was better to have him in British custody than to have to put up with him being a lousy general.
Right.
And that was General Lee, a different General Lee, of course, and not Light Horse Harry Lee, but a different Lee than that. No relation to Robert E. But apparently, Lee was not just a pain in Washington's side because he fought him politically and because he wouldn't take orders from him, but he actively worked with the British while he was a captive of the British, and it's just recently that his treasonous activities and his interaction with General Howe has been uncovered.
Right, it explains a lot of the things he did. Once you get the picture of him. First of all, he was in the British Army when he came over here. He came over here as an immigrant and a veteran of the British Army, but he saw Washington as just sort of a rube who didn't have the military knowledge that he had, and he was being ignored. So when he is captured, he gives the British an idea of how to take down the Continental Army by switching their strategy to the south instead of New England. And that's what happens. But when they get to the south and they think that the Loyalists are going to rise with them, the Loyalists rise, but not as many as the British had hoped for, and they don't become the staunch allies that the British had. And probably for the reason that you yourself just mentioned, they don't trust them. After all, they're Americans; they aren't British subjects. Even the Tories who go to England, flee America and say, "Well, we'll return to the motherland," they're treated as Americans. They don't fit into British society. The Anglican clergymen who go to England don't get jobs. And they just don't fit in. They become very clubby, and they form little organizations lobbying for better treatment of Loyalists. But the British don't really take to them because they're Americans. They really aren't British subjects.
It's sort of a sad fate for them. They really
didn't, The happiest people are the ones that go to Canada because they get a great big piece of land. And they get the right to essentially start a new country. And the Loyalists, for a couple of generations, become the political and judicial leaders of Canada.
It is a remarkable story, and even we're running out of time, and I hate not to really talk about this very much, but one other thing that's involved in this war between Americans are the Native Americans who get pulled between the two sides. The British have had a successful relationship with the American Indians. They used them to great advantage during their war with the French, and now they use them to great advantage in their war against the American rebels. And loyalists are involved in this too, and it just makes it even more complicated and really scary dangerous along the New York frontier, for instance.
That's a whole story in itself. I mean, it was like a war that was all by itself. There are times when neither the British Army nor the Continental Army is anywhere near the battles that are going on. And the battles are more like raids. In Indian and Tory groups would raid farms mostly in the Mohawk Valley, was the breadbasket of the revolution. Finally, Washington sends a major force north just to go after the Indians who had been siding with the British. And the British had been telling the Indian tribes all the way along that when the war ends, you're going to get a lot of land back. The whole frontier situation is going to change. Well, when the treaty is drawn up, there's no mention of the Indians in it. I mean, they're just cast aside, as the Tories were, because none of the Tories get their land back. All their land was confiscated. Every colony passed legislation seizing all the land, all the property of Tories, and in some cases, even threaten them with execution if they were to return to the colony.
Well,
the good story is that within a generation, things are changing. I mean, there are people coming back to America. There are sons of loyalists marrying daughters of rebels, and we do eventually leave that one behind pretty fast, about one generation.
Well, it's like they say, the victors write the history, and this might be the first time for us to get a really honest look at those who fought as loyalists or Tories against the Revolution. It's a fascinating story, and it's available in Thomas Allen's new book, Tories, Fighting for the King in America's First Civil War, from Harper Books. Harper is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishing, and you can check their website, harpercollins.com. Tom, do you have a website that they can check also?
Yeah, it's fightingfortheking.com, all one word, ToryFightingForTheKing.com. I believe I could really write another book with the stuff I hadn't used yet. In that website, ToryFightingForTheKing.com, there's one section of it that would have been an appendix to the book, but it was too long, and it's all of the military units that the Tories belonged to that I could get any information on. And it's about the equivalent of about 80 pages of information.
Wow. To check out that website and get more information and to look in their local bookstores and online and get a copy of Tories. And our thanks once again to Thomas Allen for making time to be with us today on the bookshelf.
Thank you very much for the chance to talk to you.
Thanks again for joining us on The Bookshelf. I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. And we hope that you enjoyed today's episode during American History Month. We'll have another one next week. We'll have another one next Sunday morning at 9:30 on FM 94.7 and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 on AM 970 and WTBF.com. Till then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.